have public hearings so that we can tell the country as wide a range as possible. So as to assist us in drafting the best possible legislation. So it's part of that process that we take public hearings today, ask various stakeholders to make their presentation. I'm sure that we have all received a copy of the program. We have a very tight schedule. So people who are making presentations, kindly focus on the issues at hand. And I would also ask members to be mindful of the time allocated to each and every presentation so that we can cover and canvass as wide a range of views as possible. I would now like to welcome the Casino Association of South Africa. Make your presentation, Mr. Mabuza.
Chairman, good morning, members of the portfolio. Thank you very much for the opportunity to appear before you today to contribute in the consideration of the Gambling Act amendment here. As in the past, we as CASA have been very active participants in the process that has marked the progress of the bill leading up to this point. We have provided comprehensive input to the Department of Trade and Industry, and once public comment had been sought, we participated and consulted widely. As in the past, in our practice, both here and abroad, to establish international best practices, and we've adopted our usual constructive approach, incorporating as fully as was permitted to do so in the process. Regrettably, Chairman, the consultation process was limited to one meeting with the DTR, and although that meeting proved to be inconclusive, we were promised further consultation, and that did not eventuate. Be that as it may, we appear before you today because as a responsible corporate citizen, we consider this piece of legislation to be important to the country, but more important to us as operators in this industry. We do, however, have a number of concerns regarding this bill in its current form. Among others, the department, in its wisdom, has chosen to deal with this issue as an amendment to existing legislation. Now, Chairperson, that legislation, the current legislation, was carefully crafted and was a result of a serious consultative and participative process, which today has led this industry, this government, as an envy of many countries. So there's no doubt that the legislature, the executive, and us stakeholders got that one right. And while we do not quarrel with the approach adopted by the DTI, the Interactive Gambling Bill, we would have preferred that it was dealt with on a separate bill, not as an amendment to the existing bill. We as CASA would have preferred it to have form, to have been in a form of a separate piece of legislation. I would like to stress that in our view, adoption of the bill in its current form would seriously diminish the take-up of the existing legislation because of the many deficiencies contained in the current proposed amendment bill. There are important deficiencies in the bill, that impacts negatively on the successful on its successful implementation. I will return to this later. Nevertheless, Mr. Chairman, CASA supports in principle the legislation and proper regulation of interactive gambling. Our view, however, remains that there's been woefully insufficient research and consultation, and these amendments do not do the job adequately. I think it's important as we march forward to just look at the rear view mirror and just check where we've come from. Prior to 1996, we had a substantially illegal industry in urban areas in this country in gaming. That was marked by widespread proliferation of up to 150,000 illegal machines in all urban areas. There was easy access to all, and there were no particular age restrictions. They were not regulated. The public was not protected. The payout percentages were manipulated by the operators. Winnings were often not paid, often associated with all the things that today we continue to have a bit of an overhang of accusations of our industry being characterized by those, such as drugs, money laundering, prostitution, and protection rackets. They paid no taxes, there was no responsible gambling program, and almost totally controlled by white people, with no empowerment in equity management and procurement, etc. We've had at the same time 15 casinos in the homeland, that by comparison had just under 7,000 slot machines compared to the 150,000 machines that were in the illegal gaming environment. These became a big contributor to the tourism plants and infrastructure in the rural areas such as Sun City and Wild Coast. There's no doubt in our minds that Sun City remains an icon of a tourism plant in our country, and thanks to gambling in that homeland. Subsequently, Chair, we went through a thorough process, acknowledged to be among the best in the world, which was led by two government commissions, the Howard Commission, the Vian Commission, extensive consultation and extensive research process, which gave rise to the Act of 1996, which was amended in 2004. We have looked at various models from the United States, Canada, and Australia to see what is it that must be for public good that these developments should provide with the must-see and must-do entertainment attraction. And that was followed subsequently by provincial legislation, comprehensive regulatory framework, which created a successful and a well-regulated casino industry with rigid probity requirements and consumer protection. The supply of gaming machines, which was out of control with the previous government, has now been fixed and contained. We now have a focus, which has got a big focus on public interest. We've delivered significant non-gaming infrastructure and meaningful public benefit projects. Today, South Africa boasts two world-class convention centers and associated facilities thanks to this gaming industry. Tourist attractions, most of the theaters in this country are surviving because of what the gaming industry is doing. For the Apartheid Museum at the Gold Reef in Joburg, we've got bed and wildlife centers, sports facilities, hotels, new physical infrastructure such as roads, and special catalysts for other industries. We contribute some 60 million rand per annum in community social investment. In terms of the request for proposals when we're bidding for licenses and subsequent regulations determined that comprehensive, responsible gaming program be embarked on to deal with the unintended consequences of gambling, which we as an industry are supporting to the tune of 11 million rand per annum. Internationally, this is recognized as the world's best and the world's best endeavor by the industry. 40.7% of the value added in this industry does go in revenue, or about 3.4 billion goes to government in the 2006 and 2007. And of that, about 873 million go to provinces. We have now reached a state of stability, and we are a very accountable industry. If we just go back there, Gary. Really, this industry now, represented by Casino Association of South Africa, is a voluntary association with legal standing, representing all casino operators in the country. We've got 34 casinos with 6 operators, employing over 31,000 employees, and have invested over 15 billion rand in new investments in this country since 1996. Over 5,300 new hotel rooms since 1996. We've all had the questions of, are we ready for 2010? We have made progress in ensuring that South Africa is ready to host the expected visitors. 11.5 billion of annual gross in gaming revenue, and 3.4 billion being our annual tax bill to the fiscal. And we have spent 2.7 billion with suppliers. 25% of those are people from previously disadvantaged backgrounds. In terms of black economic empowerment, all casinos in South Africa are compliant with the code of good practice in respect of broad-based black economic empowerment. And this is not a choice. Most of that chair has been our conditions of license that we have agreed with the various provincial licensing authorities. So there are a number, turning to this bill that we're dealing with today, there are a number of issues which we believe need further debate. There's clearly been not sufficient international and domestic consultation and research. The many difficulties in the bill are evidence of this. Amongst others, the taxation levels. These taxation levels will determine the ultimate success or failure of interactive industry. High levels of tax compared to other jurisdictions will discourage new operators, while low taxation will prejudice other gaming sectors in the country. Either way, the fiscals will suffer. We believe there needs to be a return to the drawing board chair, which is, in our view, undoubtedly necessary. It is questionable whether, without access to the big market, being the U.S. market, whether interactive gambling will be a viable proposition in this country, and is it worth all the pain that we all going to have to go through, and all the exposure that we think we have spent a lot of time to try and protect our minors and society from with the ills of gambling. Now, turning to the need for a playing field, all that has been achieved and all that the benefits of existing regulated industry in South Africa should not be put at risk. As I say, whilst on the other side, we're not sure that for the sake of an industry that at best could be 500 million, it's worth putting that at risk. Everything possible should be done to ensure that any interactive gambling that is introduced is done in such a way that the advantages of introducing this form of gambling exceed its disadvantages. Pure interactive gaming operators should be subject to no less stringent requirements with regard to empowerment, acceptable probity, financial strength, skill development, job creation, regulation, taxation, and prevention of underage gambling and promotion of responsible gambling than those which are applied to land-based casinos. As I said earlier, Chair, we spent a lot of time at the last 2004 bill trying to address the issues that were unintended consequences of gambling and how we can do that in the past. To throw all that out, the water with the baby, for the new fad of interactive gambling, and still not gain all the things that we sought to achieve, would, to our view, be irresponsible if not reckless.
Regrettably, there are already inconsistencies in application of standards in this industry. The lottery is an example of this. The lottery has got 8,000 gambling outlets, and it's not subjective. It's not subjected to the same advertising and other regulations that the casino industry is. And it makes no contribution to addressing problem gambling. And there's no doubt in our minds that if gambling is has got social negative effects, lottery is one that is accessible by everybody. And it has the same effect, yet it pays no price for it. All that, and it is therefore essential, amongst other things, that whatever legislation we're going to embark on has to comply with international treaties, such as the World Trade Organization on generally accepted agreements and of trade and services. The possible impact of pending litigation in Europe is one chair that I think we need to look at very, very carefully. As I said, we have in the past been in the forefront of calling for legislation that affects our interest to be evidence-based and not to follow personal preferences and predilections to influence decisions that affect our business. We have again, in the case of this amendment bill, trawled far and wide to obtain opinions in international best practices in this field. We have hoped, Chair, that Professor Joseph Kelly, one of the world's leading experts in the field of internet gambling, would be able to present to this committee his particular insights into the bill. Unfortunately, Professor Kelly has had to undergo some surgery in the United States and has been unable to travel to South Africa for this hearing. I would, however, Chair, like with your permission, to table the written comments that Professor Kelly has addressed to the committee on the amendment of the bill, which we...
Mr. Mabuse, you know what I would like us to do? When I started off, I said I would like to hear a focus on the critical issues. In your presentation, you have made mention that there are areas that the department is not addressing. We would have liked to hear about those areas. At the beginning, I also expressed the time frames that we have here. For each and every presentation, as you see, there's approximately half an hour allocation. So what we would like to be, you can't have the entire half an hour for presentation, and members don't interact and ask you questions for clarification and express views. So ideally, this goes for all other presenters hereafter. At maximum, I can give you 20 minutes to articulate your arguments, and then 10 minutes to members for questions and comments. Otherwise, we won't be able to canvass all the views within this room. So what I would like you to do, sir, focus on the issues. As you have said earlier in your presentation, there are areas where the department has not covered it. So I would like to hear more of those areas. And then whether you refer to experts here and abroad or anywhere, but as long as you do it within the time frame. So I'll give you slightly few minutes, deducting my 2 minutes that I've spoken right now. But what I'd like, forget the speeches, good folks. Let us deal with the substantive issues in front of us here. Then we'll be able to do much work. And your written presentations, if you have given it to us, we can all read. We have read this. So you can speak to your presentations. You don't need to go to it line by line. All in the interest of time. I think I would like to accommodate a wider spectrum of people, but time is not a facility that we have completely in control. Thank you, sir.
Sure, thank you. We'll keep within that time. So once more, just concluding that we would have loved Professor Kelly to be here. His written submission has been provided.
The major issue, Chair, of segregation, in our view, we cannot begin to consider interactive gambling in the absence of proposals on segregation, because whatever is going to happen in this industry is going to depend about the level of segregation that this industry is subjected to. As I pointed out earlier, the more it is, the less it will be attractive, the less it is, the more prejudicial it will be to other industries. Therefore, we should seek to deal with segregation in a fair and equitable way. Chair, the other question that I think needs to be addressed is who should be involved? Who should be involved in interactive gambling? We believe every casino license holder should be authorized to conduct interactive gambling by virtue of the casino license, which all the issues we have dealt with in the previous legislation have been covered to ensure that there is sufficient consumer protection and the ills of gambling are ameliorated. And an authorization process needs to be put in place for external operators who wish to conduct interactive gambling with persons in South Africa. Only people who are licensed in South Africa, approved external operators, and persons who hold casino licenses, in our view, should be allowed to participate in this. And lastly, many other key issues that would need to be dealt with is our guarantees to cover debt, equal access to communication platforms, the good neighborly policy, uncertainties about enforcement of the provisions, certain issues in the international sphere of what is happening with other countries, the UK amongst others, and some litigation that is still outstanding needs to be considered. So, Chair, we conclude as we propose to move forward that there is need for more research into the viability and the socio-economic implications of this, and further serious in-depth consultation with national and international stakeholders is required. And we think there needs to be serious consensus on the segregation issue. We are strongly of the view that the bill should go back to the drawing board for improvement. And if it is approved in its current form, it is our view that it would seriously undermine the excellent regulatory framework that currently exists and is very efficient. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. Members, your opportunity for comments and questions.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, Mr. Mabuza, for your eloquent presentation. Can you just explain to us, you say that the bill in its present form is not okay and it needs therefore to be improved. What are the specific areas of improvement that you would suggest in this bill? And on the other comment that you don't seem to be satisfied that the bill is introduced as an amendment bill, and you are recommending a separation. Why? Why so? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Any other member? Mr. Larissa.
Yeah, I'm concerned about your statement about consultation. Whether it's, you know, consultation is a very important element in our new society. And you mentioned you only had one meeting, as I understand it. Did you make any effort to have more consultation? Because often a kickoff meeting gets generalities and, you know, certain specifics can take place Could you just inform us, was there any other attempts at further consultation in this matter?
Thanks, Mr. Lavaskasnich. Dr. Ravi?
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Mabuza, in your concluding statement, you mentioned that more research into commercial viability and socioeconomic implications is required. Can you elaborate upon that as well? Can you give us some empirical data regarding the commercial viability and the economic implications? Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. Switch off your mic kindly, Dr. Abbey. Thanks, Mr. Mabuza. You have the opportunity for a rejoinder.
Chairman, thank you. I'll try to capture the questions as best as I could. Chair, sorry by mapping the background of where we came from with the 96 law and the amount of work that we've all been through to put the 2004 Gambling Act as we have it to be in the state that it was in. Unless and until any form of gambling can be taken in that act in its current form, all the work that was done in there, which has raised a number of issues, that the parliamentarian society was rightly concerned about, a number of issues that we as an industry learned a lot during the process of how we can be a responsible operator and still do the things that at the end of the day the benefits of this industry is more outweighs the negative. So now, just impose the interactive gambling bill in its current formation without due regard to all those things, the issue of segregation, the issue of underage gambling. Interactive gambling, by definition, anybody who has got access to a laptop and a computer and the internet would be in a position to gamble. What about kids? We've never applied our minds to that. It doesn't seem that the things that we've managed to protect in the National Gambling Act in its current form, we're going to expose those. So issues of black economic empowerment. There is nothing that seeks to address that particular aspect in this. That operators must be of acceptable probity. We don't know who stands behind this internet interactive gambling operators all the way up to the line. Today you cannot be involved in a casino industry to the tune of more than 4% without you subjecting yourself to all the probity and all the regulation that all licenses are subjected to in South Africa. We do not think those issues have been dealt with. And the level of investment. We have pointed out that in the last 8 years or so, the casino industry has invested over 15 billion rand. Why are we going to allow another industry without a level playing field? And yet we want to wrap them under the same legislation. We do believe that one, the inconsistency on the one side, and also the deficiencies that are in this interactive bill in its current form will undermine all that which has already been achieved today. On the question of consultation, Chair, we've had only one meeting with the GTI. We've had a number of requests prior to that meeting and a number of requests subsequent to that meeting, which, as I pointed out, was inconclusive anyway. We were promised that we will have further engagement. And I also don't think it is right for us as an industry to be seen as crybabies every time we have challenges of meetings with the GTI, we must rush to the portfolio committee. That's not what we're doing. We're just pointing out that we genuinely believe when we were promised that there would be further consultation, that yes, it would eventuate. It has never taken place. We have approached the GTI through the National Gambling Board over an extended period of time. Yes, Chair, we do believe that there is more research that is required. The little time that we've spent in the industry, we think at best this industry is worth no more than 700 million in South Africa. Now, the casino industry in Gauteng alone is worth 6 billion, just in context.
we do not think that the commission viability, also further exacerbated by the fact that 80% of the interactive market in the U.S. is not going to be exposed, is not going to be allowed to participate in this industry in the current U.S. legislation. We do not think that that viability actually is warrant some of the socio-economic price that we as a nation would have to pay for it.
I didn't hear Mr. Mabuza coming out clear on the suggestion that he made to separate the bill from the existing act, the reason behind that.
Second. The Honorable Member, I've been part of, together with this committee, the department and all stakeholders, have been part of the process that led to the current bill, the current act, the 2004 act, which has been lauded all over the world as a sterling piece of legislation. In there, part of the things that have come out was, now that gambling is legal in this country, now that there is the democracy which brings with it choice, that certain people might choose to gamble, others might not choose to gamble. How do we ensure that as a result of this, we get out of this activity the good that society can get in the public interest, and how do we ensure that we protect those people that would have the unintended consequences of gambling on them? In there, we have embraced a number of issues that are very South African. Issues like black economic empowerment, issues like ensuring that the operators that receive public money have got acceptable profits, issues of ensuring that the investment are of also dealing with other socio-economic benefits like tourism. What is interactive gambling going to do for tourism? The effect of problem gambling that interactive gambling will bring to our country will not be suffered by the people that are gambling overseas, will be suffered by the people in South Africa. And us, South Africans, will have to deal with it. When members of parliament sit and discuss the issues of gambling, the anecdotal statements that get thrown around are issues that only us, the casino industry, must step forward and come and deal with. All the people that benefit in the value chain of casino industry never step forward. So it is with that responsibility as the industry that we point out that unless and until interactive gambling can be done in the same way as the current gambling act prescribed, we need to deal with this separately. We cannot start with this without trying to undo some of the good gains that we had on the previous on the current legislation. It was that against that background that we we can only comment from nowhere to say it's regrettable that it is done in this. To do it in this, it has to come in line with the current legislation. Ideally, we would have preferred that it was done separately so that we can look at it in its purest of form without undermining the gains that we've done in the previous piece of legislation, which I do believe is a great legislation. We do not quarrel with the need to legislate and regulate it. Our preference would have been a separate piece of legislation. Then we can spend the amount of time we need without unduly undermining what we currently have gained to date.
Thank you, Mr. Mabuza. When you are done caucusing there, I wanted you to just remind me, you spoke about gains or loss in the fiscus, and you mentioned the figure. Could you just take me over there? And then I'll give it to Mr. Labuschagne.
Thank you, Chair. You've said a lot about the contribution that the Casino Association has made to the economy, procurement, and so forth.
how do you see that the, where do you see the deficiencies in the current bill, in the sense that they do not contribute to the second economy, do not contribute, you know, to social development? I'm not interested in taxes at this stage. You know, the community as a whole. Where is the bill deficient in this regard?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I haven't mentioned the figure on losses to the fiscal. I pointed out that taxation is not addressed in the current deal. And taxation is going to be central in determining the attractiveness of this industry to would-be investors. The higher the tax level, the less attractive. The lower it is, the more prejudicial it would be and inequality to the existing gaming industry. So whichever way to try and appease a new entrance into interactive gambling by lowering taxes, would be a disincentive for people in the current legalized gaming. Therefore, they will all migrate to the cheaper tax rate, and the consequence is the fiscals will lose. On the question of just a separate bill, we do have a situation that lottery is in the gambling space, but it's being there is a separate law that governs lottery. It was in that concept that we would have preferred the interactive gambling to be dealt with. There are no provisions in this piece of the proposed bill to deal with the second economy. Our president and the Department of Communication are on record about the inaccessibility of the ICT to the larger community. Now, by definition, to participate in interactive gambling, you've got to be plugged in. So, therefore, by definition, a very big part of our population would not be participating in that, either as a choice or also as a benefit. There are no requirements here that an interactive gambling provider would have to have so much like economic ownership. What happens when they change ownership? This is the kind of investment they must do. This is how they must subject themselves. We believe it is not required as we have all been in the industry.
Mr. Mabuza, thank you very much. Unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there. We've got your full submission. All we wanted was to highlight and focus on the issues you have covered at ground. So we'll go to the next presentation, members. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next is Petse.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good folks. Could you have your meetings outside, please? We have one meeting. Either you are in or you are out.
Yeah.
That's fair. We're in your ambulance.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to you and the honorable members of the committee. I'm Lungile Mazwai of Attorneys Eduardo Mazwai in Pretoria, assisting Betfair. And I'm accompanied by Mr. Elliot Turnahan of Betfair, who is the General Counsel. And I take this opportunity just to apologize for the absence of Mr. Veera Bodha Singh, who is a consultant to Betfair, whose name appears on the agenda, who may be known also to some of the honorable members. Her absence is occasioned by matters related to her pregnancy. What we've prepared for today is speaking notes, which we'll speak through. We've also got a slide presentation, and they're both supported by a more substantive written submission, which I believe is also before the committee members. So pretty much everything that we say in the slide and in the speaking notes is actually covered in the written submission itself. And then if I could refer you to the outline of what we intend to speak through today within the time allocated, is that Elliot Turnahan will present the two remaining items of the introduction and also the context, and then I'll do the piece on substantive submissions and the conclusion recommendation. And you'll note from the outline slide that we've also cross-referenced where those particular sections appear in more detail in the written submission that you have before you. So I could hand over to Elliot.
Thanks, Mungile. By way of introduction, Betfair is a major internet-based sports betting and gaming company based and licensed in the United Kingdom with substantial license operations in Australia and in several European countries. We try to set ourselves apart from many other interactive gambling providers in that we actively seek to become licensed and to work proactively alongside governments whose policy is to regulate, and we have a long track record in doing so. Betfair's business activities are conducted entirely through various means of electronic communication and include a full range of online gambling games and betting products. But our core business, for which we are best known, is the Betting Exchange, which uses advanced computer software to perform what is in essence a very simple idea, which is to ensure that every stake risked by one player is exactly matched by the stake of another player. This system is highly desirable from a regulatory standpoint because it provides better player safety and better fiscal stability than traditional betting systems. Betfair is proud that many of its long-standing systems for the exclusion of minors and combating corruption in sport have recently been adopted as the regulatory standard for the entire online gambling industry in the UK. In support of South Africa's long-standing policy of regulation, Betfair has, since 2004, proactively sought to become a licensed gambling operator in South Africa. It was first invited by the National Gambling Board to present its business case in April of that year, and has since sought to promote and inform the present policy objectives. In early 2006, Betfair initiated, designed and helped to fund a life skills strategy for the National Responsible Gambling Program to address the serious problem of underage gambling in South Africa, which has now been developed further by the NRGP, as you may have read in the press recently. Betfair also supports South Africa's socioeconomic and BEE objectives and is already in advanced discussions with a prospective empowerment partner. Betfair's requirements for skilled computer science graduates, call centre operators and BPO capacity puts us firmly within the industries targeted by FTSA. Honourable members, this bill sets out to regulate all forms of interactive gambling. Online gambling has merited specific consideration by a number of governments for three main reasons. One, its flawless nature makes it impossible to prove it effectively. too, in the online environment, the serious concerns about underage and compulsive gambling, the risks of fraud and money laundering, and operational integrity all require internet-specific measures in order to be addressed effectively. The traditional prescriptive approach of gambling legislation is inherently unable to keep pace with technological advances, and the Honourable Mr. Hosmany noted his concern in the last hearing in relation to this bill, that this committee's time may be constantly taken up with the need for the DPI to regulate every new form of activity. At a basic level, the internet is nothing more than a new means of delivering gambling via the medium of electronic communication. Electronic communication does not change the nature of gambling generally, and the attendant risks of the internet do not discriminate between different forms of gambling. The slide on screen shows the proportionate levels of regulated interactive gambling in 2006 in the UK context and globally. As you can see, all the forms of gambling which the Honourable Members may recognise in the land-based environment, specifically fixed odds and post betting and casino, can be and are made available via the internet. In addition, the speed and technology of the internet has enabled online poker in particular to become predominant, and its growth currently outpaces the other forms. All of these activities should be addressed in the legislation if government wants to regulate effectively in order to protect players and control the activity. Honourable Members will note that the memorandum to the bill introduces a concept that it describes as interactive gambling activities that take place between two or more persons facilitated by a third party. In industry terms, this is referred to as person-to-person gambling, or P2P. As you can see in the middle of the middle section of the slide, P2P encompasses several different forms of gambling, which together account for at least 25%, and certainly as far as the UK is concerned, 40% of global interactive gambling. Understanding this concept of P2P is central to Betfair's submission, because the memorandum and the text of the bill seek to exclude P2P from the proposed regulation. All the forms of online gambling shown in the graph, including player-to-player, are common and already have a proven demand in South Africa. Some are already licensed to be made available in South Africa. Others are proposed to be regulated by this bill. And some are proposed to be specifically excluded from this legislation. We are mindful of this committee's concerns regarding the legitimisation of any form of gambling. However, it's an important pillar of this bill and all similar legislation around the world that the inability in practical terms to police any prohibition means that if player protections and controls are to work, consumer demand must be able to be satisfied by those providers that are licensed and regulated. It's therefore essential to apply regulation uniformly and not to allow loopholes or exceptions of any kind. Honourable Members inquired of the DPI as the experience of countries that prohibit online gambling. This slide is provided to show the size of the illegal market globally relative to regulated activity. Empirical evidence shows that the more one restricts the range of permitted online gambling, the greater the size of the illegal market, which is why independent consultants GBGC estimate a tenfold growth in online poker in Africa between 2006 and 2012, whether or not this bill is passed. With that market context, I will now hand back to Mr. Mazwai, who will deal with our substantive submissions in two parts. Firstly, we submit that the proposed exclusion of certain forms of interactive gambling seriously undermine the regulatory objectives. And second, we submit that the practical and combined effects of various shortcomings in the application and drafting of the bill in its current form is to prevent the policy objectives being achieved.
Thank you, Elliot. Honourable Members, as I said, I think we have three documents before you. One is the slide presentation, which we have on the screen. The other is the written submission itself, which has got 30 pages. And we have then the speaking notes, which are 13 pages, 1-3. If you'd like to follow where we are on the speaking notes, we are now on page 5 of 13. If you'd like to follow that. Exclusion of certain forms of interactive gambling is the first part, and then I'll deal with the practical consequences. In dealing with the exclusion, there's just a little bit of background which I'd like to mention before we make the 5 points that we do under this heading. And the first of part of the background is that when the National Gambling Amendment Act of December 2006 was published for comment, there was no mention or any reference to any form or forms of interactive gambling which would be excluded from regulation. Secondly, the bill was published in the Gazette on the last day of July 2007 for public comment, proposing for the first time the exclusion of player-to-player interactive gambling. Thirdly, when the committee saw clarity on what was in fact being excluded at the briefing on the bill by the DTR on 8 August this year, the NGB on behalf of DTR explained that the intention in the bill was to make a prohibitory statement regarding P2P betting exchanges, thus indicating that the exclusion is intended to apply only to P2P betting exchanges. The memorandum and the bill do not refer to betting exchanges. And lastly, as a background, is that Betfair now understands the NGB will conclude all discussions with provincial licensing authorities in respect of its findings by the end of this month, August, and may propose further amending legislation to this committee to cater for betting exchanges within about 3 months from now. And the points that we make here are really five. The first is that any exclusion undermines the objectives of regulation. As noted from Mr. Kernahan's presentation, several forms of P2P interactive gambling are made available on the Internet, and all fall within the description in the memorandum and the Act of what is proposed to be excluded. Now, from our perspective, irrespective of the language used, the likely effect of the legislative exclusion as proposed in the bill is to prohibit, and Betfair's submission in this respect is that the proposed exclusion is then structured as a prohibition. If I could refer you to the slide on the screen, it will be noted that two things in essence. Firstly, that the description of P2P was to apply uniformly to such activities, the bill would fail to protect players or impose regulatory controls on 40% of online gambling activity, including poker. Secondly, even if it were narrowed down just to address exchanges, there would be a break in the fence that seeks to protect South African players, and that would have been done intentionally by Parliament. So our submission in this respect is that any exclusion of an interactive gambling activity, whether the 14% or the 40, impairs government's ability to pursue the policy objectives espoused in the bill and significantly increases the risk that South African players will continue to be exposed to the undesirable factors listed in paragraph 1.1 of the memorandum to the bill relating to criminal elements and lack of protection for children and other vulnerable persons. The second point is that there is no policy basis for the exclusion of certain forms of interactive gambling. Is that the rationale for excluding P2P gambling that's given in the memorandum is that the implications of this form of interactive gambling are currently being investigated. The essence of this rationale is with respect that we ran out of time in the investigation to the consequences of permitting P2P gambling, which investigation, as Bears mentioned, began in 2004, before the Principal Act itself came into effect. No policy reasons have been articulated to date to this committee as to why any or all forms of P2P might merit consideration separately from other forms of interactive gambling, let alone exclusion, or as to why betting exchanges themselves merit specific prohibition. Our submission on this aspect is that if there is to be an exclusion of one or more interactive gambling activities, then the purpose of the exclusion must be clearly established and the extent of the exclusion must be clearly defined. The bill in its current form with respect fails to achieve any of the clarity. The third point we make is that the proposed exclusion of certain forms of interactive gambling is discriminatory. Betway operates the largest betting exchange and is the only offshore exchange seeking to be regulated in South Africa. If indeed the NGB wishes to target betting exchanges rather than all P2P, the effect of such a prohibition will be to prevent Betway and Betway alone from submitting to South African jurisdiction. We'd like to make some submissions on the development of the gazetting of the initial bill of 2006 and the current bill, and these are the observations I would like to share. Firstly, is that Betway hasn't been afforded adequate opportunity to comment on the bill, nor to consult with the DTI on the bill, the current bill we're talking about. Secondly, Betway was denied the opportunity to review and comment on the bill with the benefit of all the information which it sought to obtain, one of which is an NGB report of 2006 on betting exchanges, which is of relevance to the committee. We've had some exchange of correspondence on this with the NGB, and copies of that correspondence are attached to the written submission right at the end. The third is that procedurally there's been inadequate public consultation on the bill, as noted by the committee on 8 August and acknowledged by the DTI. The inadequate public consultation process is exacerbated by the fact that as of the 20th of August, the DTI website homepage had a link to the bill of December 2006 and not the bill currently before the committee. So it might make it difficult for people who had intended to come and make presentations to have the correct bill before them. And then just on public consultation, we'll just refer to a case that might be of some interest, where the decision of the Minister of Arts and Culture approving a name change from Louis Tricha to Makodo was reviewed and set aside because there was inadequate consultation with local communities and other stakeholders, and that was a recent decision of the Supreme Court of Appeal. The explanation of the proposed exclusion and targeted activity interpretation by the NGB is not backed up by the text of the bill, in that the bill makes no reference to betting exchanges, and when one is referenced to the definition of interactive provider in the bill, that prohibits a person other than a bookmaker from providing P2P gambling. If there is indeed a cogent policy basis for excluding P2P, such policy is directly undermined in the bill because exclusion does not apply to bookmakers, in that bookmakers are not required to comply with the player registration and other protection measures as set out in the bill, thereby creating in favor of bookmakers as against all other license providers an advantage. The exclusion, as is presently expressed in the bill and the memorandum, would effectively extend to the online businesses of the Republic's two licensed totalizers, and it's just interesting to note they don't seem to be on the agenda for today. The fourth point that we wanted to make is that even if the exclusion is justified on policy grounds, it can be circumvented in that the one transaction of one player to another player could be recharacterized by an operator into two transactions, where the first transaction is between player one and the operator that ends, then you have a new transaction between player two and the operator, and then you no longer have a player to player. So the policy behind excluding P2P is fairly important. And then the last point we wanted to make was just regulation of future forms of interactive gambling, is that if the legislature is inclined to pass the bill in its current form with the exclusion, then Betway would suggest that the legislation includes a mechanism through which the excluded player-to-player interactive gambling and any future forms of online gambling could then be resolved and determined. I'll now take the committee to the next slide dealing with the substantive parts of Betway's submission, which are not related to the proposed exclusion of P2P or betting exchanges. And if you're following, we're on page 9 of 13. The second substantive part of our submission highlights certain other aspects of the bill that in Betway's view give rise to serious practical risks that the DTI's policy objectives can never be achieved under the bill as now drafted. And what these aspects highlight is with respect to an apparent disconnect on the part of the DTI's between the objectives of the regulatory policy and the effect of the bill itself on the activity sought to be regulated. And here we make the following submissions, which I'll go through very quickly. It's really 6 points. The first one is that the player protections are not uniformly applied to all providers. The player protections and operator safeguards set out in the bill, which collectively form the framework by which the bill seeks to protect the public and control interactive gambling, are not thought to be imposed upon all licensed providers of gambling on the internet. We understand that this is a deliberate but unarticulated variation from policy expressed in the memorandum based on the concurrent competency of provinces to license these forms of activity. However, the risk to players, which this committee is being asked to protect against, applies to all forms of gambling on the internet, and these risks do not evade the provincial boundaries. Currently, no provincial gambling laws provide any player protections of the kind recommended under the bill. Without the uniformity, not only does the bill extend to competitive advantage to certain classes of operators, but more importantly, it creates a two-tier framework of player protection and industry controls, which expose DTI's policy to the risk of eventual failure. And if I could refer to the slide now, from which clearly shows that the combined effect of failure to regulate all relevant activity is that the large bulk of interactive activity would not be regulated. And for as long as it's outside the scope of the bill, there's inadequate control, which equals to inadequate protection. The next point was that the bill is not technologically neutral. It favors activities of existing operators. The current bill has omitted a main provision contained in the December 2006 draft that would have ensured that the framework of player protection is technology neutral. And that was a paragraph 7 in the previous bill, which inserted a new paragraph 5A, which cast the net of regulation across all forms of gambling, which take place using means of electronic communication. Its sudden disappearance without explanation now means that the bill relies for its scope exclusively on particular forms of gambling that are already authorized to be provided by the incumbent licensees in the land-based environment. And such a handicap, to the extent that the existing licensees may retain their present exclusivity, will accordingly limit the level of new BBB investment in what technology investment and skill transfer into South Africa. The next point was that the onshore server requirement handicaps policy objectives. There is a section 37.4 in the bill which imposes an obligation on the license provider to locate all its interactive gambling equipment in the Republic, and there doesn't seem to be any discretion given to the license to waive, whether in whole or partial, this particular requirement should the operator be able by some other means to satisfy the equipment monitoring and security requirements. And we note that in the UK that discretion is given to the regulator. Such a stringent onshoring requirement fails to take account of the fact that most operators at which this regulatory policy is targeted have already made very significant investments in acquiring licenses in other jurisdictions. And as the bill is currently drafted, those existing offshore operators will have to forego both their investments and their licenses in order to submit to South African jurisdictions. It is impossible for world-class operators to have their equipment in every jurisdiction. If we as South Africa had been the first jurisdiction to make this requirement, then the other jurisdictions would have been in the position that we find ourselves in at the moment. And our submission is that the legislators and the regulators concerned to exercise a level of control over the operator and its equipment can be achieved, as is the situation in other jurisdictions, without requiring that equipment to be actually located in the Republic. The next point was that the player age verification measures, while they are there, they lack rigor, in that one of the most important player protections that any government seeks to impose in the gambling industry is the requirement to exclude minors from accessing gambling activities. In the UK, this requirement is articulated by obliging online licensees to take active steps within a limited time period following player registration to age verify that player. Information enabling the operator to do this varies depending on their location. However, in order to create a player incentive to age verify, no player is permitted to withdraw any winnings from a UK player account unless he or she is age verified by the operator. So there's a positive obligation placed on the operator. By contrast, our current section, while all the other thresholds for compliance are very high, this one merely requires the operator to obtain a statement from the player that he or she is older than 18. And it's very likely that most operators could in practice automate the giving of the statement as part of the player's acceptance of the terms and conditions without necessarily drawing specific attention to it. And then the next point that we're making is that the nominated account requirements undermine player retention and industry sustainability. Several provisions in the bill are already at odds with player behavior, such as the ability of licensed providers to attract and retain players materially undermined. And then the last point we're making is that the drafting of the bill does create uncertainty in trying to stick to the time. I won't go through that and maybe just go to the conclusion. Is that the policy framework informing the bill is both sound and achievable. While the initial bill of December 2006 had its own shortcomings, its articulation of the policy objectives was preferable to the current bill. The shortcomings and inadequacies of the bill demonstrate a less than comprehensive understanding of both policy and operational issues, perhaps occasioned by the incomplete investigation on all matters pertaining to the regulation of interactive gambling. And is that notwithstanding what one's position on morality or legitimization might be, it seems to us that firstly, this is a complex and dynamic subject matter. Secondly, that it does require due consideration to be given to it to enable a well-informed decision to be made, and that a hastily made decision without all the relevant information runs the risk of leading to the consequences described in paragraph 1.1 of the memorandum, rather than those described in paragraph 1.6 of the memorandum. And that regulating risks posed by the internet is really the issue, and not so much specific games or providers that we should be trying to regulate. And that the protection and control mechanisms in the bill are of high quality and should apply across the whole spectrum of gambling activities and not just some of them. And in the spirit of assisting the drafting of the BET legislation, we have some high-level solutions. And the first is to avoid any form of exclusion or prohibition, whether that's broad or narrow, which would in turn obviate loopholes of confusion, some of which we've referred to. Secondly, is to apply the player protections and regulatory requirements uniformly to all forms of interactive gambling, including bookmakers and totalizers. Thirdly, to remove obstacles to customer retention, so to protect those who participate. And lastly, to apply measures to enable onshore providers to submit to certain jurisdictions. In the circumstance, we propose that the bill be rejected in its current form to enable the current shortcomings and inadequacies to be resolved and to implement the solutions proposed to the extent acceptable. We'll take this opportunity to thank the honourable members for listening to us, and we'll be glad to try and answer any questions you may have.
Right. I didn't show you the red card to show you that you're in injury time. The reason being that I've had information that the South African Council of Churches and the Muslim Judicial Society will not be making submissions. So that gives a little time. So I will not say that it was an act of divine intervention on your behalf, but that's a subject for another matter. Honorable members, questions, comments? Mayor Ramudit.
Thank you, Chair, and I would like to thank the presenter, Lungile Mazwai, and Attorney Zigaba Mazwai. I note the concern by the presenters being afforded an adequate opportunity to comment on the bill, which I think was also a concern raised by the previous presenters. However, I wouldn't agree with the comparison made by the same presenters in terms of consultation here, the comparison actually. Because here we are talking of a new phenomenon that is being introduced. But here we are talking about gambling that has been there, you know, all the time. And therefore, I would really not agree with this comparison. Maybe if the presenters can also share to us as how they contribute to the BEE, because I'm not totally convinced here by this entire internet gambling, the contribution made to the BEE. And then lastly, where is the last one? Okay, I think I'll pause there. My other point is lost.
It's in cyberspace, Mrs. Beth might be able to help you locate that point. Comrade Hushman?
Yes, sir. Two points.
One is the issue of contribution to black economic empowerment, broad-based black economic empowerment. I think you have heard the previous presenter talking to this matter and saying that as CASA, they are compliant to codes of good practice. And for the internet gambling, it will be difficult for them to contribute towards broad-based black economic empowerment. And your statement, you said that is possible, and you have started some discussions with some other bodies or persons. Can you clarify us on that as to how would you see yourselves as maybe internet gambling as a whole contributing towards the policies of intervening in the second economy in this country. Now, on page 713, you raise an issue about the exclusion that seeks to prevent bad faith alone, if it's done in this way, alone from submitting to the South African jurisdiction. Can you also try and enlighten us around that point? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Comrade Hussman.
And also, I think the DTI also talked to the fact that age restriction is going to be applied in this particular type of gambling. And we have also alluded to that. Can you, and the previous, can you contrast that to the previous submission that we listened to just now, this morning? And how do you actually, so that we are all clear, they say this type of gambling would not prohibit people that are underage, and you're saying it is possible.
Thank you. But, I avail you the opportunity for a rejoinder.
Thank you very much. Chairperson. I think I'll allow Elliot to perhaps deal with the BE-related questions and the age verification, and then I'll deal with the remaining questions.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, in respect of the inquiry regarding black economic empowerment, I think firstly a technical observation and secondly a substantive one on our own behalf. In a technical respect and perhaps slightly contrary to what the previous presenters were submitting, the Principal Act in its current form, and one would imagine similarly in the context of the present bill, already provides the licensing authority with the mandate and indeed the requirement to take into account the measures that the applicant is to take in respect of black economic empowerment. And naturally enough, with the recent promulgation of the new code from the DTI, there is more detail and more clarity around the manner in which those requirements are to be met. And our submission would be that, in fact, exactly the same requirements should be applied by the licensing authority to those online operators that would seek to submit themselves to South African jurisdiction. As for the substantive point, certainly in Betfair's case, as we have said, since 2004, we have been actively engaged in various respects in South Africa. And at a very early stage, we actively sought to understand, and we have since fully subscribed to the objectives and the initiatives of broad-based black economic empowerment. We have initiated discussions with a wide range of potential partners, and as we've said in our submission, we're currently in detailed discussions with one in particular who we've identified as being a very good fit for us in particular. But I think the broader point that is worth emphasising is that this industry brings some new opportunities for the delivery of those objectives into South Africa. Because it is a highly technological industry, and the predominant employment activities that are required to be provided by the online provider is a different range of employment skills required by existing land-based operators. And so I think certainly when you're thinking in terms of the regulatory objective of ensuring that those providers that already service existing consumer demand should be to provide the opportunity to introduce them to South African regulation, there is all that expertise and all that technology that can be brought into the country at the same time. Many of the skills that we require from our employees in particular, and I'm thinking particularly of call center operations, computer science and technical skills are not specific to the gambling industry, and in fact are transferable as employees in the normal course of events move on to other employment in other sectors. If I might quickly address the age verification issue, I think the point that we would want to emphasise is that because age verification and the exclusion of minors is so important in the gambling context, there should be a regulatory objective imposed on the providers of the activity to actively verify that those people that approach them and register as players are of age. And the bill attempts to do this to a certain degree, but our submission is that the extent to which it will achieve that will not be the equivalent of other licensing jurisdictions, because it doesn't impose the active obligation in the current draft of the bill on the provider to perform age verifications. There are many measures that are available to interactive providers to ensure that their players are of age, and as we've referred to, and I would be very happy to go into detail as to what Betfair does, but I won't for reasons of time. But suffice to say that many of the measures that Betfair applies have been adopted as the regulatory standard in the UK. Thank you, Chair.
If I could, Chairperson, probably just add 2 points on the answer to the BEE, or triple BEE, and then to answer the last question. The 2 points would be that as far as pursuing and achieving the broad-based black economic empowerment requirements, Betfair would clearly look to its BEE partner to champion exactly what it is that can be done, when and how, and that would be in addition to any requirements that may be stipulated by the licensing authority and regulator, which would presumably be the NGV. So there are ways in which it can be achieved and without being, there are processes in its nature which allow for those objectives to be better fleshed out to say exactly how we're going to do them. And then,
as a whole industry, not only that, as a whole industry,
absolutely, which is, I'm suggesting, would then be also the role of the licensing authority. And also about, I understand that the conversation is still ongoing about the codes for this particular industry. So those help to then set the framework to say exactly what is it that needs to be achieved in all the 7 categories, and then presumably it also becomes the role of the licensing authority to ensure that no license is granted without meeting those requirements, and that if during the license period any of those requirements are not met, the appropriate remedial steps are taken, which could include losing the license. And then there was the question about why only Betfair on page 7. I think the short answer is that it is a result of the confusion created in the way the bill reads. And this is what it really is. If the exclusion wording used in the memorandum and the bill means all P2P, that would include totes. But we understood that there was a clarification that was given on the 8th of August that was not intended to mean all forms of P2P, but only betting exchanges. So that if it only means betting exchanges, here comes the confusion, is that if you look at the definition of interactive provider, it says nobody is permitted to provide a P2P gambling activity unless you're a bookmaker. So if you're a bookmaker, of course you can do it with pleasure. And interestingly, you don't even have to comply with the requirements of fair registration. However, if you are not a bookmaker, then you're not permitted to do it. And that's where we say then that would discriminate specifically against Betfair or another betting exchange, which is not a bookmaker.
Thank you. Mr. Labuschagne, I'll take you last.
Thank you. I'm not so concerned with you, Canela, but you running the right standard for this operation in the UK. And you mentioned, how many, I'm very computer literate, so forgive me, is that that's my generation. You're playing against a computer. You're not playing against a person on the other side operating the computer. So now, how many people are employed in your operation in the UK? What is your investment into infrastructure and so forth? I mean, to put it simply, I suppose if you had a fancy enough computer, you could have 2 guys who are totally, or 2 ladies, BEE compliant, stick a big computer in a garage, and run this operation for many, you know, lots of money. But there's no spin-off. Sure, if something goes wrong, you employ some consultant to fix your computer. But what is the spin-off in terms of employment, your social interaction, and so forth? I'm sure you can write the odd check out and give it to charity, but employment, your infrastructure that you're putting in.
Okay, mentally.
Thank you, Sir President. Just two questions. Now, if a person gambles via the internet, how do you make sure he is not underage? How do you monitor that? Do you need that person to provide his age to somebody or what? You know, in our days, children of the age of 10 years are computer literate and they can do wonders on the computer. How do you monitor that? And who is going to monitor that? Now, you indicate that this type of gambling is not different from other forms of gambling. And you also indicate that this game is a game of skills. Now, if it's a game of skills, do you think that it excludes the underage? Because we have talked about the underage who are computer literate. And how are you going to make sure that the person who's playing with the person on the other side is not underage? Thank you.
Thanks. Aspects of your first question has been covered, Manti, but I'm sure they cover a portion of it. Betfair, you are really betting for your living today.
Thank you, Chair. Something we tend to make a habit of. Shall I first address the questions relating to infrastructure and contributions to the economic advancement of the countries in which we're licensed? Specifically, Betfair employs in the UK about 900 or 1,000 people. In Australia and countries in Europe, we have probably an additional 200 or 300 people. We have recently sought to increase our technological expertise by outsourcing a considerable amount of our software development outside the UK. Part of the reason for that is that we have, within acceptable financial boundaries, we have exhausted the pool of the necessary expertise in the UK. So we have recently embarked on a project to hire 200 new software engineers in Romania. When that project is exhausted, completely independently of my involvement in the company, and remember that there's 1,000 people, South Africa is the next opportunity for us to source skilled computer science graduates. And as I mentioned earlier, the skills that they apply in our business tend to be, in many cases, very many cases, transferable right across the IT industry. So that's some indication of the level of investment. Then, in financial terms, the software that we have developed specifically for the betting exchange, which is one of several online gambling products that we happen to offer globally, we have spent in excess of, I'm going to convert to rands if you'll permit me, in excess of 700 million rands in developing that technology. This is a global business. Those numbers by global standards are actually relatively low when you compare us to the giants that you see advertising already in South Africa like Tata Poker has spent considerably more. I think the point that I would wish you to take away is that although there are some operators that do operate in a garage, the opportunity exists for this bill to create the chance for reputable operators to establish a base of operations in this country that is licensed and thereby provides the protections that we're all seeking to impose upon or provide in order to shelter those players that do participate. And it's only by giving players a choice of regulated or not regulated that you can effectively achieve your policy objectives.
Injury time.
I've already addressed the age verification matter, Chair, so the only thing to add to that is that there is provision as part of the licensing process and indeed in this bill for technical standards to be developed and applied to licensees that could require, that could impose specific requirements in respect of age verification to address the Honourable Member's concern.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Obviously, your area is one that will still elicit many comments and questions. So as we go forward with this process, we might need to consult with you, if not call you back. Thank you. Could we go to the next presenter? National Treasury. Financial Intelligence Center. Tell me as soon as you are ready. Are you ready? You are waiting for one more. The gentleman from National Treasury assured me that they plead innocent to the charge of having been involved with the recent bond rate hike. So please don't raise that matter. Fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the opportunity of presenting our view here. First of all, I quickly want to introduce ourselves. My name is Peter Smith. I'm one of the managers in the Financial Intelligence Center in charge of the legal section. With me, I have two of my colleagues, Mr. Sean Stander and Mr. Ronald Stearman, who have helped us with the collecting of the material and putting together the presentation. And behind me, I think, is Mr. Temekele Plaatje, who is the parliamentary officer from the National Treasury, and has helped us also with the arrangements for the presentation. Together with the slideshow presentation that I'll quickly run through today, we also have a written submission which we will leave behind for you to read further and which gives a bit more background information on the issues that we'll touch on in the presentation. First of all, we intend in the presentation to cover just a brief background on what the Financial Intelligence Center is, because it may not necessarily be known to the members of the committee. We normally interact with the Finance Portfolio Committee here in Parliament, and also a brief background on what money laundering is, how we understand it, how we see it happening. We will also provide some examples of how we believe an internet casinos specifically or internet gambling facilities could be used to form part of a money laundering process. And we will propose some measures which we believe should be taken into consideration for inclusion in any legislation that would aim to regulate internet gambling or measures that may already be in the bill but need to be strengthened. First of all, the Financial Intelligence Center is a body created by law. As part of the public administration, it's a government body created by legislation, with the objective firstly to identify the proceeds of crime and to combat money laundering and financing of terrorist activities. And these are spelled out in the legislation that created the Financial Intelligence Center. And we do this by making information that is collected by the center through reporting to the center, etc., available to investigating authorities and in some cases also to the revenue services. So we're basically a collection point of information which we can obtain from various sources, including international counterparts, which we would make available to assist law enforcement in investigating criminal activity and more specifically activity relating to the proceeds of crimes such as money laundering. Now, money laundering, as a very simple definition, is the process that a criminal would go through to make the proceeds of crime, make those proceeds appear to be legitimately acquired income. This is done through a series of steps. It's not a once-off event. And when these steps are combined, the net effect of the process would be that the nature or the source, location, who owns, who controls the proceeds would be obscured, would be concealed or disguised. Now, briefly, the process would start off with money, sometimes in the form of cash, for instance, if you're talking about drug trafficking or arms trafficking, etc., but sometimes in the form already in within the financial system in an electronic form, if you talk about fraud, with the proceeds generated from criminal activity. Then a series of steps will follow. Firstly, what normally in common literature is referred to as a placement stage, which is where the funds are actually introduced in the financial system so that they can be manipulated. And if you're talking about cash, there are various ways that these would be introduced. It's mainly through the banking system where small amounts would be divided among a number of people, deposited into a number of bank accounts and converted at some later stage. Cash would also normally be smuggled across borders and deposited in other jurisdictions where controls are less strict over banking systems, etc. Once the money is in the banking system, the process actually starts from there, firstly by dispersing the cash through as many transactions and across as many jurisdictions as the launderers would choose. This is done by dividing the funds in various transactions, transferring it through bank accounts, transferring it between locations or between persons, buying items, luxury items with the cash and reselling those, and moving the cash away from the original location where the crime took place or where the cash originally went into the financial system. The point about this second phase, which is normally referred to as a layering phase, is that a series of transactions are stacked on top of each other, and the effect of that is that the original source where the money came from becomes blurred, becomes obscured. And each transaction actually creates an audit trail which reinforces the appearance of legitimacy for the fund. So the idea with these transactions is not to destroy the audit trail, but to create a false audit trail. If this second stage is successful, by the end of this series of transactions, the fund would actually not be distinguishable from legitimate funds within the economy. The third stage in the process would be where the criminal would then want to bring the money to the funds in the system to a point where it can be collected. This is normally referred to as an integration stage because then the funds from the various locations, transactions, businesses where the money went to would be converged into front companies or seemingly legitimate businesses or even genuinely legitimate businesses from where the criminals can then extract the proceeds. And the extraction would then normally take place in the form of dividends that would be paid or investments that would be redeemed or even false transactions that are created to provide a justification for payments to go to the ultimate beneficiary from the criminal enterprise. And the end result of this is that the criminal is able to enjoy the funds generated from the crime without being associated with the crime originally, and even to reinvest the funds in perpetuating the criminal activity. And I think the important, two important points about this picture that we would want to stress is firstly that there isn't one single transaction that makes this possible. This is a series, a continuation of transactions. And if you imagine looking through a kaleidoscope and seeing a picture scattered, that is basically what the intention is behind it, the multitude of transactions that would go into a money laundering scheme. The second point is that if such a scheme is successful, it places financial power in the hands of the criminal at the end of the chain, which, as I said, can then be used to perpetuate crime. And in perpetuating the crime, the criminal would look to make the crime easier the next time around, to make the process flow easier the next time around. So you would always find corruption following closely after money laundering, where access needs to be gained to financial systems, or the gatekeepers to the system needs to be bribed to oil the machinery, so to speak. Now, why should this be combated? In the first place, money laundering is all about crime. It's about legitimizing the proceeds of crime, creating the false appearances that are able that enable criminals to continue with their criminal activity. And as I said, the financial power that is placed in the hands of criminals is then used to undermine the integrity of banking systems, of judicial systems. The tank that flows with being associated with the money laundering scheme, for instance, for a major financial institution, would have serious impact on the stability or the integrity of the system. And the concomitant corruption that flows with money laundering can, if it's left unchecked and it reaches endemic proportions, undermine the rule of law and even democratic systems, as we've seen in certain countries around South America, for instance. Another good reason to combat money laundering on the positive side is it enables law enforcement agencies to take the profit out of crime to some extent to reduce the incentive for criminals to engage in criminal activity. Apart from criminalizing money laundering, which is done in South Africa in terms of statute, it's a criminal offense, there's also a regulatory system in place which requires financial institutions and other institutions that are at risk of being abused for money laundering, such as casinos, for instance, to do certain things, including identifying their customers, keeping records of their customers' identities and also the transactions that their customers perform, reporting on suspicious or unusual activity carried out by their customers when they engage with these institutions, and to have in place the internal controls that are required for them to meet these obligations, such as appointing of compliance officers, providing training to staff, etc. All of these measures are subject to an international benchmark that is set by an organization called the Financial Action Task Force, of which South Africa is a member. And the level to which a country implements these measures must accord with this international standard that is generally applied across many of our trading partners, for instance, and most of the countries in the developed world. Is also being increasingly implemented in developing countries such as in the southern and eastern African region. Specifically, as part of this international standard, the issue of supervision and regulation is addressed. And the standard specifically refers to supervision, for instance, of casinos or the casino industry, in addition to supervision of banks and financial institutions, etc. In relation to casinos, the casino industry, the international standard requires that casinos must be subject to a comprehensive regulatory and supervisory regime. And this supervisory and regulatory regime should be at least able to achieve certain things, such as preventing criminals from having a controlling interest in a casino, specifically through the licensing process and the probity checks, etc., that are applied within that process of licensing casinos. And secondly, that their operations must be subject to effective supervision to make sure that they do continuously comply with the obligations that are imposed on them, as I've illustrated in the previous slide. So there must be a process of routine checking, spot checks, examinations, etc., carried out in relation to the casino industry to give the quality assurance that they are on their compliance. And this supervisory system, which applies to casinos, whether they're land-based or internet casinos, would also be subject to scrutiny by the international standard-setting and assessing bodies who will measure the level of supervision by supervisors. Now, I said we will briefly give a few examples of how we believe interactive gambling can be used as a part of a money laundering scheme. I've read in literature recently a statement from one, probably a representative from an internet casino association, stating categorically that there is no possibility, no risk for money laundering in internet gambling. And we would beg to differ with that. First of all, there would be two sources, we believe, of a threat of abuse of interactive gambling. On the one side, it might be come from the side of the gamblers themselves, because the punters who would go online and use the features of an internet casino as part of a money laundering process. But secondly, it might come from the operators of the casinos themselves, who would be using the access that an internet casino would give to bank accounts, etc., as a front to receive and transfer funds. Just a few examples. For instance, a person would be able to register with an internet casino, open a player's account with the casino, and credit the account from funds in a bank account, which, as I said, may already have been credited with the proceeds of crime. The person would not need to gamble online, but let's say they do gamble and then end their session, playing session for that period with the casino, and then instruct the casino to do something with the funds that it has standing to the credit of the player. The instruction would be to pay out these credits to a different account from the one that was used to buy in or to credit the player's account in the first place. And this second bank account might be in a different location, might be subject to the control of another person, although it's opened in the same name as the player. And the effect of this would be that the funds have moved from one location to another and from one person to another. But if you look at the transaction trail, the records of the bank, the first bank account, the bank where that account is held, would only show the transfer to another account. And it may or may not be that that account is identifiable as a casino account. But let's say it is. The records would not show what happened to the funds after that. The fact that from that casino account it was transferred onwards. It would only show that no money was returned to this account from which it was transferred, and the logical conclusion would be that the player lost all the funds to the casino. And there would be no way of reconstructing the series of transactions from the paper trail that connects the two accounts where the money came from and went to. Now, there are variations on this theme where the same effect would be achieved. For instance, in a case where there's a land-based casino with an internet casino facility attached, or an internet casino together with a land-based casino in the same group. Again, the player would credit the online gambling account with the internet casino and would then go to a land-based casino within the same group and maybe take an associate with him to this land-based casino. In the land-based casino, the person would then draw the credit from the account that was credited with the internet casino and buy chips with that credit. In other words, transfer the credit from the online casino to the land-based casino. Buy chips with that credit, hand the chips over to the associate who would be able to cash the chips. And bear in mind that this casino doesn't necessarily need to be in our jurisdiction. If it's part of a casino group with resorts across the world, etc., the casino might be in an offshore location where this transfer of chips would then take place. The person who then receives the chips would instruct the casino either to cash the chips and issue a check or transfer the credit to the balance for the chips to a bank account. And again, the effect would be the same, that they would be on the basis of the bank records, no way of reconstructing this movement of the funds, but the net effect in practice is that the funds have moved. In the case where the players would play against each other, which was the subject of the previous presentation to the committee, should that be possible? One way of effecting the transfer of funds through this method would be for two players to enter an online poker game, for instance. Through placing bets that are above the average for the players on that in that particular game, they would make sure that they eventually become the only two players in the game, and would then simply proceed for the one to lose against the other. And the funds would then be transferred through the internet facility to the winner in this case, who would then be able to instruct the host of the facility to transfer the funds into the bank account of his choice. And again, the effect would be the same as the funds have moved. On the issue of the operator using the casino as a front, and this would very much depend on the ability to properly license and exercise control over who gets access to internet casino facilities. A person would acquire an internet domain, set up an internet casino, and register the players of his choice, which would be the associates of the criminal enterprise. The internet casino as a business would be able to open a bank account for its operations, and the gamblers would then, or the so-called gamblers would then simply proceed to log on to the casino, lose to the casino, and therefore creating a justification for the payment of funds from whatever accounts they hold to the casino's account, where their associate is in control of the system would collect the funds and be able to make it further available. Now, as I run through these examples, I think the point that we want to make here again is that it's not any of these particular transactions that would cause money laundering. The money wouldn't be laundered through this particular transaction in and of itself, but this would be part of the bigger picture that I've shown you earlier, where a person, for instance, would need to transfer funds and would make use of this medium to do that and create a justification for the transfer of the funds. It would always be associated with a bigger scheme where there would be other steps involved in the process. But the fact of the matter is that this is one of the methods that would form part of a process if one needs to find a way and a justification for moving funds from one location to another or from one person to another. Now, these concerns are not just what we have identified. There is some international studies that have been done as far back as in 2000, for instance, the Financial Action Task Force did a study on internet-based banking and internet-based casinos, and identified certain threats in that study, which are particularly related to the features of an internet casino being based on the internet as a communication medium. And I think the important issue for us here is that it's not entirely correct to say that because there are risks in casinos, generally land-based casinos, there must also be risks in internet casinos, because we don't believe the risks are necessarily the same, because of the business model and the business processes being different in internet casinos and land-based casinos. the internet, the risk related to internet casinos is very much related to its features as an internet-based entity. And it relates to the fact that customers are firstly acquired in a non-face-to-face environment. In other words, where the casino actually never has physical contact with the customer, with the punter or the gambler. Secondly, in the ongoing relationship with the client, there is no personal physical contact with the client. So the ongoing relationship with the client is also conducted in a virtual environment. And certainly, thirdly, there are certain uncertainties over the jurisdiction of where these activities actually take place, which authorities, which regulators have the authority to investigate should things go wrong or to prevent certain activities from happening, etc. But more importantly, also the ability to enforce jurisdiction, which is a problem if one for instance, looks at the ability of law enforcement officers to execute a search warrant, where the information that they would be searching for is out in an offshore location, which is beyond their reach. So there are more issues than just subjecting yourself to a country's jurisdiction that needs to be considered. The issue about non-face-to-face identification or acquisition and the relationship of customers. In terms of our current legislation, which requires banks, etc., casinos, etc., to identify the client, it is not excluded that the client may be dealt with in a non-face-to-face environment, but what is required is that the institution must then put in place additional measures which can satisfy the fact that it cannot compare the physical appearance of a person with an identity document at a face-to-face meeting. So there must be something else. If that step is not there, there must be something else put in place to compensate for that, and which can give equal certainty that the casino or the bank or whoever knows who they are dealing with and that this person is in fact who they claim to be. They're not somebody usurping somebody else's identity and presenting that to the institution. And this comes to the claim that there is no ability or risk for money laundering in internet casinos, because the argument is made that the funds must already be in a bank account for it to be transferred to the casino, and therefore the bank has already done the check, the bank has already identified the client, and the internet casino can now rely on the bank's verification. We believe it's certainly unfair to pass this obligation of the institution, which is the institution's own legal obligation, off on another business in a different environment. But secondly, the casino, when that it deals with that client, there's no surety that the person that they're dealing with is in fact the person whose identity is presented to them. So if I have a bank account of Mr. Seaman here, who has been identified by the bank knows exactly who he is, issued him with a credit card, etc., but I sit with that credit card and I gamble, the casino would have no way of knowing that, and with no way of establishing that. Secondly, because of the ongoing relationship with the casino not being carried on in a face-to-face environment, it would make it difficult for the casino to pick up unusual activity on my part, because it has no relationship with me, it doesn't know me, it doesn't know my source of income, the level of transactions it would expect from me, etc. And it would simply be dependent on very generous business rules or principles are coded into a computer system to identify what it may believe to be suspicious transactions. And we believe this would seriously undermine the ability to report suspicious or unusual transactions on the part of an internet casino. In relation to record keeping, I've made the point that if the records are held offshore, even though the casino would be complying with the legislative requirement to keep records, those records would not be accessible to either local law enforcement agencies or to local regulators who need to have access to those records to ensure compliance compliance checks. So I think one of the key elements of our record keeping obligations in terms of our legislation would be missing. Thirdly, in addition to the obligations that relate specifically to the legislation that the FIC administers, there's also the issues of jurisdiction and supervision and enforcement, which we believe should be considered. In relation to jurisdiction, operators that are based outside of South Africa will not necessarily be subject to all the legislation within South Africa that applies to a land-based casino, even though they subject themselves to the supervisory jurisdiction of a regulator. That doesn't mean that they subject themselves to the search and seizure powers, for instance, of law enforcement agencies, should they even be able to exercise them. But, if a casino based in the UK subjects itself to the South African legislation, we don't believe in the current framework that means that a law enforcement officer from the South African police can get on a plane and go and search the records in London or in Gibraltar or in Antigua, wherever the casino may be operating from. And in many cases, it's not physically possible to determine where these records are in fact held because of the nature of the internet and the way it's constructed and the need to trace the various links in the communication chain to find the server at the end of the chain where the transactions is actually captured. In relation to supervision and enforcement, our issue is mainly around capacity more than provisions in legislation, although we believe there are certain things that can be added to the legislation to strengthen the hand of the supervisor when they deal with licensed or not, rogue casinos. As I said, part of the function of a supervisor would also be to carry out certain checks and examinations on the operations of the casino in relation to its compliance with identifying its clients, reporting transactions, keeping the records, in addition to all the licensing conditions, etc. And these would have to be carried out on a regular basis with its annual visits, etc. Assuming that internet casinos could be based, licensed internet casinos in South Africa could be based outside of South Africa, that would place the obligation on our supervisors to actually go and supervise them at the location where the operation is conducted from. Unless the converse is possible and all the information that needs to be accessed by the supervisor can be brought within reach of the supervisor inside our physical borders. On top of this, we believe that one of the key aspects to supervision would be the probity checks, the licensing process, to make sure that unscrupulous operators are kept out of the system. And this would mean having access to certain information on the background of applicants for licenses, for instance, criminal record information, tax status, information in relation to previous applications in other jurisdictions that were either accepted or turned down. And it is doubtful that a South African regulator would necessarily have access to this if the person is based in a different location. It would not be possible for a South African regulator to get access to a person's criminal record information in Switzerland or wherever. The authorities there would simply not allow access. Similarly with tax status, tax status is normally one of the things that is treated as very sensitive information by jurisdictions. And is usually the best aspect of access to information which countries will allow, where they would still allow search and seizures, etc., to take place across border. They would be reluctant to share tax status information, which we believe is an important part of the probity check for prospective licensees. And then, as I said, the additional challenge of carrying out the necessary compliance checks and then examinations if the operation is conducted from offshore. A very important point to this is that although most of these contraventions would be regulatory in nature and would require a reaction from a supervisor either by imposing penalties, instructing remedial action, or even withdrawing or suspending a license, some of these might need to be addressed through criminal investigation where the contravention was actually part and parcel of a complicity in a money laundering scheme. It's not simply a regulatory oversight on the part of the licensee. Again, in the case of offshore jurisdictions or offshore located operators, the possibility to institute criminal investigation and prosecution would be seriously hampered. Some of the measures that we would propose, we would start off by referring to the application of probity checks to ensure that the first protection in the system is who you allow in and who is kept out. And here we believe as much information as possible should be built into the probity check, and the regulator should be in the strongest possible position to refuse a license from a proposed applicant with facing endless challenges and be tied up in debate with a prospective applicant on the decision to refuse the license. What goes hand in hand with it is the ability for the regulator then to keep unlicensed operators out of the system. Otherwise, there's no sense in providing for the license in the first place. But this also means that non-compliant institutions should face the possibility of having their license revoked, and that should be a serious enough threat to honour their obligations. It's no use if they can continue with business as usual with or without a license, and the threat of revoking a license in fact means little to them. And this comes, I think, to the technological issues of being able to address the ability of internet casino providers to provide their services within our jurisdiction if they are subject to our South African licensing conditions. One of the issues that could be explored in this area, which we think requires further thought, is to introduce methods that could restrict the flow of funds through South African financial institutions to internet casinos that are not licensed or whose licenses, for instance, are suspended or revoked. We do not believe that enough thought has gone into this, exploring this possibility. But if a gambler in South Africa needs to access a casino, an internet casino from South Africa, the likelihood is high that he would be using a South African-based bank account to access that casino. And if the flow of funds from that account to the casino can be prevented in the case of an unlicensed casino, I think that gives more effect to the issue of having a license. I think, as has been pointed out, is the issue of subjecting to jurisdiction, but that should not only be limited to subjecting to the jurisdiction of South African supervisor. It means that subjecting to the legislation that supports the framework from achieving results, such as the ability to carry on a criminal investigation, for instance, without needing to resort to mutual legal assistance requests and extradition requests, etc., which would place a foreign-based licensed operator on the same footing as a locally based land-based casino or locally based internet casino. Then, in addition to subjecting to a jurisdiction, we believe there's the issue of establishing some sort of domicile or a footprint within South Africa. We've heard the explanation in the previous presentation about requiring a foreign internet-based casino to locate the server from which the operations happen within South Africa, and we understand that there is certain practical difficulties with that. But we believe certain alternatives to that should be explored. Inasmuch as one wouldn't expect the internet casino operator to establish thousands of servers across or hundreds of servers across the globe, I think one can expect a foreign internet-based casino to establish some form of a presence within our jurisdiction, such as incorporating a company, for instance, in South Africa that is subject to our jurisdiction, establishing premises where contact can be had with the supervisor, etc. But most importantly, we believe what this should include is a place where the information relating to South African transactions should be kept. For instance, if a South African gambler with a South African bank account accesses a licensed casino, the transaction records of that, the transactions that take place at that casino, should be kept within South Africa's jurisdiction where it can be accessed by law enforcement agents. It's no use for that, the internet casino side of the records to be kept in Gibraltar or Antigua where we have no hope of accessing this. Then I believe, as we've indicated, there are certain obligations under our legislation. The Financial Intelligence Center Act that applies to banks, applies to land-based casinos at the moment on customer identification, etc. That would also apply to internet casinos should they become licensed. But what has not been explored fully is what would be the ability and the possibility for internet-based casinos, especially foreign internet-based casinos, to actually comply with these obligations. And should they not be able to comply with these obligations, what would be the reaction from a supervisory side or a regulatory side in South Africa? How would we enforce these obligations in relation to internet-based casinos? We have been through a very intensive discussion very recently with the banking industry on the issue of opening bank accounts via cell phone, which is very much a similar model where a non-face-to-face environment of acquisition of clients takes place. And to date, we have not been able to be presented with sufficient technological answers to the identification and that one step in the process, which I've mentioned, that needs to be provided for, which would be the obligation of the institution, but in practical terms would be difficult for them to demonstrate. I have touched on the ability of supervisors to take action in the case of non-compliance, and this would be very much a capacity issue as well as a jurisdictional issue and something that can be strengthened in legislation. And the issue of having South African-based information that can be accessed should the need be to investigate any of these transactions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen from the Treasury. I would like to suggest that we take a comfort break until 11:30. The cheapest watch in the room says it's 11:15. So we'll resume at 11:30 for questions with members and then move to the next presentation. Thank you. Can someone also check out the air conditioning? Marcel? People are becoming comfortable and sleepy in here now.
Yeah. Yes.